following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the host and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Joining us now, America's Sheriff. Sheriff David Clark, America's Sheriff. Go to americasheriff.com. Sheriff Clark, great to have you. So let's get to your friend in New York, Jerry Nadler. What is up with this guy? 8,000 subpoenas he's sending out. Basically, if you worked for the president in the campaign or in his company, you're going to get a subpoena to just ask you questions. Like, it's in search of some crime that may have been committed of which they have no evidence. Have you ever seen anything like this as a sheriff in your life?
No, I haven't. But we knew this was going to happen. You know, we talked about it before the midterms, and that was the importance of trying to turn out the vote to keep the Democrats from controlling the House of Representatives. We knew that it would be nothing but this investigation after investigation, you know, for the next 2 years. So that's what's upon us right now. But what's more disturbing to me is, you know, this all-powerful force of the federal government is being turned on private citizens. It's one thing in the political field, as you know, in the political environment, for certain things to go on. You look at it, and it's kind of politics as usual. But when this stuff gets turned on the American people, it really turns my stomach.
How does this play out, Sheriff?
Well, I think, you know, as this goes on, the American people will tire of it. There's a reason why Congress has an approval rating of about 18%. And it's for this kind of stuff, the kind of stuff that goes on in the swamp in Washington, D.C. Nothing gets done. There's a lot that needs to be done. The president still wants an infrastructure bill for our crumbling infrastructure. The Democrats don't care about that. We need that southern border sealed. We need it fixed. We need this broken and illegal immigration system fixed. But the Democrats don't care about that either. They just want to play politics. They're still trying to undo the 2016 election. They're trying to weaken the president's approval numbers. They are in search of and on a path toward impeachment. They're not hiding it at all. But over time, the American people get tired of this stuff. They get tired of the politics as usual in Washington, D.C., the back and forth. But this is what you get when you get a bifurcated government. And it was one of the things that, and you know, the voters, they get to make the decision.
Right.
And they did. The Democrats did a better job of getting their people out to the polls than the Republicans with the 40 or 45 GOP members in the House not running for reelection. You know that incumbency is a very strong thing. I think the poll I saw, or the survey, I think, or research, 95%. Of incumbents all across the country get reelected. So the Republicans gave up the power of incumbency, and they really didn't have a plan to replace those people. A lot of experience went out the door, and you know, they seem to have just given up, you know, on the old adage that in the off term of a presidential, a general election, that it goes to the opposite party. Well, you know, that might be the pattern that has developed over time, but that doesn't mean that it's a guarantee. So I think they just gave that up. But here's what we got. The next 2 years, nothing's going to get done. But it will probably come back to bite the Democrats in the rear end, because this isn't what the American people want out of their government in Washington, D.C.
I agree with you 100%. And I'm not sure that Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff and these eight committee chairmen that are doing all these subpoenas, I'm not sure they're looking at 20 in a realistic way. I know they're a slave to their left-wing donor base, and this is what a lot of their activists are demanding, but you also got to be smart. Look, I'm not going to give them advice because I think this is a losing strategy. And as the president said the other day, and I've said it earlier in the week when when they started the hearings with Cohen, it's like if Pelosi led with, here are the five things we're going to work with the president on to help the lives of average Americans. We're going to do infrastructure. We're going to rebuild our crumbling roads and bridges and train system and expand Amtrak so it actually goes places that people want to go. And then they could say, Look, the second thing is we got to get prescription drug prices down. Obamacare is here to stay. We have to fix it so we can bring down the cost in some way. We have to take a look at colleges that keep raising tuitions. I mean, if they did that, you know, there would be a reason to reelect them in 2020. Sheriff, I've said this all week. Look, the Republicans in 2020, Sheriff, need 19 seats to flip back to them to win, to take the gavel away from Nancy Pelosi. 30 Democrats got elected in 2018, 30, in districts that Trump carried in 2016. Now, he's going to be back on the ballot in 2020, stronger than ever. I mean, they're at risk. They're not going to hold the majority of those seats. It's a matter of do the Republicans pick up 18 or 25 of them. And so I think their strategy is just a disaster for them. But, look, this is a short-term deal, I guess, right?
Yeah, and if you know, if there's a plan put forth to gain some seats by the RNC, it could be done. But here's another thing that I'm worried about. I think there's some storm clouds on the horizon in terms of the United States Senate. 21 GOP members are up for re-election, and I think there's only 10 or 11 Democrats that are up for re-election. Those numbers were in our favor in the midterms, where I think 21 Democrats were up for re-election, and so the with the help of the president, they were able to increase the control of the Senate by a few seats, but that could flip as well.
Right.
And I think that's what the Democrats are going to eye in 2020, in addition to the White House, is if they can't win in the White can't beat the president and take over the White House, they can surely take over the potential to take over the United States Senate. And then they're one more step, a building block away from having complete control, and that'll be a disaster for this country. So now is the time for us, you, I, the voters, Trump supporters, to have a real sense of urgency about this thing, about what's going on, and to, you know, stay engaged, to keep working, keep fighting, don't get discouraged, because that's what the Democrats are trying to do as well, is discourage Trump voters and then hopefully peel some off. It's not working right now. It's not going to work, but they're still going to move full steam ahead. When they start prying into people's business, private citizens, I looked at the list. I was surprised that I wasn't on it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I looked at some of the businesses like the NRA and private citizens. You start poking around in their business, you know, very distasteful. It's very anathema to what the founding fathers set up in terms of self-rule and getting the government to just stay out of people's lives and leave them alone.
Well, I don't think they're going to do that. Look, both of us think it's going to blow up in their face, but time will tell how this plays out. We're with America's Sheriff from Milwaukee, David Clark. You can get more information. Go to americasheriff.com. That's americasheriff.com. Sheriff, I want to get your reaction to, I know you've spent a lot of time at the southern border. I want to get reaction to some of the numbers I got in a meeting at the White House yesterday, right? So what they're saying is more than 76,000 aliens arrived illegally at our border in February. This, of course, enough to fill up a massive stadium. So this data shows 76,000 illegal aliens apprehended at the border in February. But here's the problem. We don't know how many got in that were not apprehended. So if 76,000 got apprehended, how many came in that were not apprehended? Five times that amount? No one knows. That's the problem. When you were there, what is the percentage, do you think, of those that we apprehend and those that we don't apprehend that come in?
Yeah, it's hard to say, but it's a great insight. Those are the numbers, like you said, that they can, that they know were trying or did get in illegally, and what about the ones that don't? It's projected now. I saw a figure yesterday where March could see 100,000 illegal aliens entering into the country. It's starting to pick up again, but again, you know, from Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and Democrats, we get, oh, nothing to see here. There's no crisis. This is a manufactured crisis by the president. No, it's not. And as you indicated, I was there. I spent 4 or 5 days in there in two of the sectors in Texas. And it is a crisis. So when you look at the amount of illegal drugs that are getting into this country, I think the figure I saw, 70,000 Americans died as a result of fentanyl and opioid addiction, opioid use. and it's coming in through our southern border. These are the things the American people want Congress to work on, but the Democrats have turned a blind eye to that thing, and they want to play politics with the president instead of giving him the resources that he needs. And I think what he asked for was very reasonable. He tried to cut a deal with the Democrats, but as you indicated, Democrats aren't interested in working with this president. I think President Trump knows that, but he still has to put his best foot forward to expose the phoniness, the phony nature of the Democrats. So these things will go on without being fixed. The border is a mess, John. I'm telling you, it's a mess. And you know me, I don't engage in hyperbole.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes a lot to really shock me or to get my attention when what I saw down there was unbelievable. And just a few days that I was in McAllen, Texas, I think they rounded up in 2 days 60 illegal aliens that crossed into the country. And then in Sanderson County in the Big Bend sector, the day before I got there, there were 45 illegals that were rounded up. They don't have enough boots on the ground to deal with this. The president knows that. He's tried to get them more money. And so it's a combination of things that are needed. But these are the things that the Congress should be working on instead of handing out all these subpoenas, this political witch hunt to get the president and to try to peel off and destroy the people around him, the people like you and I and others that helped him get elected to discourage us from helping out in 2020. But I can tell you right now, the president can count on me. When I give somebody my word, they could take it to the bank. I'm going to help and do everything I can to get this president reelected.
Well, we have to do that, no question about it. And I'm going to be in the same position, obviously, and hopefully we can get him over the top. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a tough 18 months. But look, I think Bernie Sanders, I predicted this whole week on my show, Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee. And I wouldn't take it lightly. I know a lot of people say, wow, you know, easy victory, great in the debates. You know, he's a socialist. The guy's got a following. And he's going to pick off a couple of these Midwestern states, perhaps, potentially. And he's going to win. Look, I don't care who the nominee is. All the blue states are going with that nominee. It could be Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, AOC. It doesn't matter. They're going to win those blue states. So it, you know, comes down to a handful of states. I think Sanders is going to be tougher than meets the eye, but I think if he's the nominee, we do win, and that is going to have to be top priority. Hey, final question here, Sheriff Clark. I just want to get your take on this. Did you ever think we'd be in a situation where we're actually defending capitalism when the economy is growing at 3.5% and everybody has a job? Have you – I mean, it's like – I don't know what world I'm in when I get up every day. Like, why am I defending capitalism when the economy is exploding? I mean, you do that when there's when you're in the depths of a recession or a depression, you might look at an alternative system. I mean, does this make any sense?
Not at all, and you're right. And in a very short period of time, too. But this is the result, as you know, many of your listeners know, the result of the destruction of our K-12 public education system and our university systems across the country that have turned into laboratories of liberal and socialist indoctrination. That's what's going on. So what you have is now generations of people coming up, particularly under 30, but around that age range, that were in these school systems when this was being pushed, socialism, that it was idealistic and it was a good thing, and they actually believed this stuff because they've been duped, John. But these are the people now who are going out to the polls. These are their followers. It's like a cult. I wrote about it in my latest column at townhall.com, the cult-like psychology of progressivism. And so now they've unleashed these individuals onto our government structure, and yeah, they support this stuff, this nonsense. They have no idea what socialism really is. They don't understand that its forebear is communism. It goes from socialism, then it goes to communism. But we're seeing some of the dictator-like behavior out of the Congress, like you said, with these, you know, this mass subpoena request that's been put out there on the American people. But this is the fight. This is what we're up against. But I've suggested, and I put it in my piece, that one of the best ways to undo this is we have to regain control of our public K-12 education system. These are laboratories of indoctrination for liberalism, progressivism, and socialism, and they're no longer institutions of learning. But that's where that's how the Democrats started this stuff. This started like 2-3 decades ago. This didn't start a couple years ago. And basically, we fell asleep at the switch while our school systems were taken over by these this socialist indoctrination.
I want to thank Sheriff David Clark for being with us. More information, americasheriff.com. Sheriff Clark, a senior contributor with America First Policies. Follow him on Twitter at Sheriff Clark, and you can read his columns. townhall.com. Hey, Sheriff, thanks for being with us. Victoria Cobb, the executive director of the Family Foundation in Virginia, she fought the ERA. I was in favor of it, and I said that was another stupid thing the Republicans would not do. I said they will not let that die in committee. They can't be that stupid. They won't let it die. It doesn't matter what Cuccinelli says. They want to win an election. It's going to be litigated for 50 years. Bring it to the well, I predicted, and vote on it so Democrats couldn't run ads against them. And, of course, the Republicans did the exact opposite, much to the glee and delight of my next guest, Victoria Cobb, who led the fight to not get the ERA passed in Virginia. And we can call her Victorious Victoria.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
In fact, I think there's a... there's a singer by that name, Victorious. My daughter used to watch that show, whatever it was. They went to high school and they were singers or something. But okay, so let's talk about your ERA Pyrrhic victory. But now you get the victory. But now that the Democrats are going to run ads against Republicans saying they don't like women.
Well, there's no question that more needs to continue to be done on the education level about why this thing is harmful and why it isn't just a benign statement about women. So, you know, we're going to be part of that education effort. We're hoping to be able to really contribute to the electorate beginning to understand this, because you can't just move the legislators. You've got to, you know, make sure the people are moving along with you, and it isn't what it's been sold to be. So that is our challenge in front of us.
All right, so how are you going to do that? Because you know they're going to be spending a lot of money on ads. So right now, this has been a tough day for the Republicans in the Senate, Victoria, because we understand Wagner is going to retire or get a job in the administration or something. He's announcing today, this is what we've heard, that he's out. That seat in Virginia Beach. Now, whoever the Democrat is, they go from the underdog to the favorite one day. So that's a likely pickup for them. It's going to be tough to defend that seat without Wagner there, because he is the master at it. And then they're way behind in the District 13, Dick Black's seat. He's retiring. Democrats way ahead there with John Bell. And now they just rigged an election in Southwest Virginia, which is bad PR.
Yeah, the Senate, it is going to be an uphill climb for the Republicans in the Senate. I think everybody, it's been that way, and these factors just make it that much harder. And boy, I am so frustrated, like you are, with the rigging of these elections where parties can't really choose a nominee. It's unbelievable.
I mean, what do you think of this? The Southwest Virginia District 40 thing, I can't get over it. This Steve, I don't even get into the House of Delegates member, Southwest Virginia, Steve Landis.
The thing. Their deadline just came and went 5 seconds after he announced, too.
I know. So he did the same thing. But at least Landis gave everybody 12 hours. He gave
this
everybody.
Is the thing, though. People cannot – you do not get the best candidates for office when you give them 12 hours to decide.
And they gave them 12 hours.
That's the thing. You know, you're going to get the bravest, gutsiest, but not even having enough thought. I mean, that's what's – it's alarming. It's disappointing. It is why people unplug from politics. It is why people like me, who are even passionate about the issues and policy, feel – you know, their stomach turn when they think about party politics. You know, we find in our organization, our base just keeps growing, and it's growing with activism that people are no longer contributing to political parties. And I don't think they understand that this is the kind of thing that sends people running either completely out or over towards just sort of staying on the issues and staying away from the mechanics.
That is a great point, Victoria. I think you're onto something here. Why would you donate to the Republican Party of Virginia when they just rigged two nominating processes? processes in Southwest Virginia. One guy gives 12 hours notice. The other guy, Carrico, makes his announcement after the deadline is passed. He gives 30 minutes delayed notice. It's already passed when he makes his announcement.
I was at lunch yesterday having this exact conversation about how many donors I know that have told me in the last couple of years they give nothing to the party anymore, that they used to be donors that would also give to the party and the candidates, and now if they give, it is specific candidates and then outside interest groups. They do nothing to RPV, nothing towards that concept, and I think they're killing themselves. They're, you know, these and maybe that, you know, maybe there's room for something in the process that legislates the concept that you have to retire with enough notice. You know, that basically a party can't hold its nomination process before you retire. You know, something like that. Maybe there's room for improvement on, you know, setting some boundaries for these parties.
Yeah, well, you have at least 2 weeks. Like, if you decide to not run for re-election, you have to give 2 weeks, regardless of what the deadline is. If you are not retiring,
right?
You just have to give people time to breathe and figure it out. And the situation with Carrico's district, I mean, that guy Ken Heath is only a candidate because somebody tipped him off 30 minutes before, and he ran over there and got to the guy's house that he tracked down at 11:59 with his declaration written on the back of an envelope.
The question is, do our incumbents or do our candidates believe in themselves and what they stand for enough to run a race? I mean, is that the message we're sending, is that, you know, there's fear of actually having to, I mean, because those battles, although, you know, sometimes they get ugly and sometimes, you know, all of that, those battles are good for people to fine-tune, this is what we stand for, this is the kind of delegate or senator we want to bring to office. Those are valuable to the party for shaping, and they're missing those opportunities.
Well, you're so right, Victoria. That is such a good point, because it's really a stain on the candidate. Like, I'll give you an example. Senator David Söderlein in Southwest Virginia did the exact same thing.
In
2015. I mean, the thing was rigged, and, you know, he was the aide to the guy that retired. I can't even think of his name. And longstanding
Senator
there. Smith, right? They rigged that. And I got to be honest, I have never had a conversation. Like, I don't want to talk to the guy. Like, I don't, if he had just gone through the nominating process, won the mass meeting or the caucus, you know, I'd go to his office, I'd do my show there, I'd have a relationship. Like, I don't even take him seriously because the guy was part of that rigged system.
And
it's
he
like,
does
don't
not
you
line
have
up
enough
100%
confidence
with Smith, and so there are differences that I think people would have liked to know about. You know, when somebody's a handpicked candidate, the only assumption you can make is they're going to vote identically, and they actually don't in all cases, and I don't think the party got a chance to evaluate that.
No, absolutely not. And like you say, I mean, don't you have enough confidence to just run your election? I mean, if your House Delegates member Todd Pillion, and you're a dentist, and you've been in the House of Delegates, and you represent a part of the Senate district, don't you have the confidence to take your message in front of Republican, whatever the nominating process is, and have a debate and talk about what you're going to do and win legitimately? Why do you have to cheat?
Well, and I'll tell you, in this particular district, I don't know if this was a factor, but certainly for, and this wouldn't be of interest to you necessarily, but for groups like ours, there's a lot of anti-casino backlash down there that they might have wanted to run a candidate. And Carrico's blocking that, and maybe, you know, all I'm saying is that's a worthy discussion to at least be having if you're the area that's about,
absolutely,
you know, that's about to get a casino.
Absolutely.
So anyway.
I mean, it should be part of the debate. I am in favor of casinos, but that should be a part of the debate, just like I was in favor of ERA. That should be a part of the debate. Anyway, we're out of time.
Yep.
Victoria Cobb, we call her Victorious Victoria. And on the ERA, she absolutely kicked my butt three ways to Wednesday, defeating the Godzilla of the truth. You're like Mothra. You crushed me like a bug. Victorious Victoria.
Sorry to do it to such a worthy opponent.
I know, right? I mean, I got annihilated. It wasn't even, I mean, they never got it out of committee. And I was like, there's no way you're going to keep this bottled up in committee, Victoria. There's no way they're going to.
Radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm John Scott. Sunday's deadly crash of a Boeing 737 MAX 8 jet in Ethiopia bears a striking similarity to an accident involving another MAX in October in Indonesia. The plane was new, the weather was clear, but something was wrong and pilots wanted to return to the airport but didn't make it. 157 people died in Sunday's crash in Ethiopia. Venezuelans have become desperate as the country's worst blackouts take their toll. Engineers have restored power in some places after electricity and communication shut down nationwide Thursday evening, but outages are persisting in many areas. The average U.S. price of regular grade gasoline up 6 cents a gallon over the past 2 weeks to $2.50. That's according to fuel analyst Trilby Lundberg. And the last surviving daughter of Hall of Fame baseball slugger Babe Ruth, Julia Ruth Stevens, has died. She was 102.
All right, here's the great selling point of Relief Factor. Well, actually, the greatest selling point is that it works for the great majority of people who use it. But the big selling factor is really this. You can get all the pain relief benefits of Relief Factor without the negative side effects of ibuprofen. A couple of years ago, with great sciatic pain, I would take ibuprofen a lot, and it helped, but the side effects were so awful after a while that I just had to discontinue use. But that's not the problem with Relief Factor. So that's huge. So if you've been using any form of ibuprofen, now you don't have to with Relief Factor. Go to relieffactor.com, check out the pricing, and please give it a try because pain is pretty awful. Or call 800-500-8384. That's relieffactor.com.
Dr. Gene A. Youngblood, pastor of First Conservative Baptist Church, invites you to worship with them 9:30 a.m. Sunday for Bible study, 10:45 a.m. Sunday expository preaching of God's Word, 7 p.m. Sunday expository preaching of God's Word, 7 p.m. Wednesday Bible Q&A with fellowship meal. They're located at 12021 Old St. Augustine Road in the heart of Mandarin, just 1 mile south of I-295.
Internal Revenue Service. When you owe a personal or business tax debt and can't pay, just hearing those three words brings feelings of fear and anxiety. I'm Jonathan David Suryash, Managing Tax Attorney at J. David Tax Law. Everyone knows that if you owe the IRS and don't pay, it's only a matter of time before tax liens, wage garnishments, or bank levies happen to you. The first step to resolution is our no-cost consultation. We take the time to go through your specific tax problem step by step. We explain exactly what your options are and how we will resolve your tax issue. J. David Tax Law is a local firm right here in Jacksonville, where only an experienced tax attorney will represent you. Our fee payment plans are affordable for everyone. If you have tax problems, call us now for a no-cost consultation at 904-507-4777. That's 904-507-4777, or find us on the web at jdavidtaxlaw.com. That's jdavidtaxlaw.com. Peace of mind is only a click or phone call away.
Ramona Flea Market has stuff. New stuff, used stuff, fun stuff, kid stuff, stuff to put stuff in, stuff to build stuff with. And who needs all that stuff? You! And what do you do when you have too much stuff? Sell your stuff at Ramona Flea Market. Open every Saturday and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Book your space now. Call 904-786-3532. Ramona Flea Market, Ramona Boulevard near I-10 and 295.
I thought I told you never to interrupt me while I'm working.
Join the live Twitter discussion.
I'm Twittering. Did you get my tweets? I just quoted all over the place.
Follow John Fredericks at JF Radio Show.
Joining us now, FOJ, that's a friend of John. Danica Rome, as you know, we supported Danica in the last election in 2017, a Democrat over Bob Marshall, although I didn't think she was going to win. She did, so we were happy about that. Danica is the first transgender the first openly transgender woman elected to the Virginia House of Delegates ever. And she is also a former local newspaper reporter, like how I started. She's a lifelong resident of the Manassas part of Prince William County and a stepmom. And those that follow me know that I have been a gay rights activist for a very long time. I've been thrown out of enough Republican parties to start a new company with. Believe me, I've been thrown out of them for my backing of gay marriage and also for the LGBTQ community. And as you know, Donald Trump, one of the reasons I backed him, first Republican ever to knock that issue off the table in one day. And he did the right thing there. Now, Danica with us. Danica, welcome back. Danica, let's go right to the meat here. You have been targeted by the Westboro Baptist Church. This is in a series of protests they're doing after the General Assembly is over. So I don't know what they're not protesting your policies or your votes, right, which is legit. But now they're protesting you, and they're having an organized protest against you personally after the General Assembly is out. You've raised $26,000 off that, which is your right to do. What is going on with this?
So I don't know. Maybe news just gets to that very narrow part of Topeka very slowly. That I was elected in 2017, sworn in January 10th, 2018, completed session in 2019 on February 24th, and then they are going, oh, now it's a great time to protest Danica's existence in the legislature. And it's just like, really? That's, okay, pat. Like, how else do you even respond to that? I mean, because it's like the legislature's out of session, and they're trying to convince the members of the legislature to scream at me and to shout me out and all this other sort of stuff. And it's like, it's the end of the Ferris Bueller movie. It's like you go up to them and you're like, it's over. Go home.
Well, I mean, this is why I find this to be a despicable act, because I have no problem with the right to protest anybody. I mean, Westboro Baptist Church, I'm not even going to comment on that. I'm not a supporter or a member, but they have a right to organize whatever protests they want. But you would think that they would organize a protest against you if they so chose based on your voting record or a policy position that you have taken in the House of Delegates in the Virginia General Assembly. That's perfectly legitimate. But what are they protesting?
As a transgender woman, and especially as a trans woman serving in the Virginia State Legislature in the House of Delegates. And, you know, like in the 2017 campaign, I was told that I was defying the laws of nature and nature's God. I had to deal with vile hate speech basically on a daily basis. And if anyone thinks that winning an election makes that go away, it doesn't. I mean, you know, I still put up with that sort of stuff. But at the same time, I look at this and I go, okay, if this is substantially not much different than a lot of the hate speech I already have to put up with in the first place, then number one, if you're on the same side as the Westboro Baptist Church on their top issue, you may want to reexamine your policy position or just your rhetoric in general. And number two, I look at this and I go, then you know what? If they're protesting my existence, then that just means I'm doing a good job in the legislature. That means that, like, my constituent service focus is not what they're going after. They're not going after my four bills to fix Route 28. They're not going after those three bills they actually got passed through, you know, the General Assembly this year. They're not going after, you know, anything that I'm dealing with on government accountability or transparency in local government or feeding hungry kids. It's like they're just going after crap. And I think we're probably, you know, you and I, John, you know, having dealt with a lot of vile hate speech from, you know, that sort of, you know, some of those sort of folks before from a long time, you just kind of look at it and you go, like, okay, it's a carnival show. It's just that they're barking at you. But what's the right response? Do you amplify their message and respond to the message? No, you don't. Or do you instead say, all right, I'm going to take something that is supposed to be inherently negative, I'm going to flip the script on it, and I'm going to turn it into something positive. And the positive thing that I can do is say, like, okay, well, what is the thing that they are most against? they're most against me being in the General Assembly. Well, I mean, me existing in general, but being in the General Assembly. So I said, okay, then how about I raise money off of what they're doing for my reelection campaign to blatantly defy their hate and come back to Richmond again in 2020. And so for the 2019 general election, I've been raising money off of this called the Westboro Backfire for since last Friday. And through 5 days, we've raised more than $28,000 for more than 800 donations from all 50 states and D.C. I represent the House of a district in the House of Delegates. You can tell people really, really don't like the Westboro Baptist Church on the one hand, but they also appreciate my message of inclusion and the fact that, you know, I've actually somehow managed to, you know, keep a good, you know, reputation and a good, you know, character intact all during my General Assembly of service at a time when it can be very challenging and people of all stripes get attacked on a routine basis. I've been trying to just do a good job, and people recognize that, and that's why we've raised more money in the last 5 days from the Westboro Backfire, as I call it, with the hashtag in front of it, than I did the first 3 months of my winning, successful 2017 campaign combined. That should tell you about, you know, what people think about the message that I have, about my record, and as well as about the absolute disdain that people have for the hate that they bring. And I had someone come up to me on Sunday saying, I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing because the Westboro Baptist Church protested my cousin's military funeral. And so that was in Virginia. That was at an event that I was in Fairfax County. And I look at that and I go, like, that's horrible. And I want to say thank you for your support, but I just feel terrible that someone would ever do that. And the message to that is, whether they're protesting military funerals or whether they were protesting Matthew Shepard, when they are being horrible to Americans, when they are being horrible to anyone in this country and protesting people in their worst time of mourning and grief, that should be a uniter for all of us. All of us should be able to say that we don't put up with that and that we stand in solidarity with each other.
Look, again, they're protesting your right to exist and the fact that you're in the General Assembly in Virginia as the first openly transgender woman elected. So, you know, my thing is go recruit a candidate in your district and then go beat you. And that if they don't want you there, I mean, that it's up to your constituents.
I don't know what candidate wants the backing of the Westboro Baptist Church,
I mean, that's it. I mean, but that would be the thing. I mean, or protest against a policy that you have, but to protest your very existence as a human being and your choice is it really is a sickening thing to me. I don't even know who would get involved in that, but they do. We're with Danica Rome. She is a Democrat representing, speaking of her district, the 13th district, which is Manassas Park and part of Prince William. She defeated Bob Marshall in 2017, longstanding Republican delegate there. And as you know, she's the first openly transgender woman elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. And, you know, one of the best lines, and I've said this on the radio to my listeners during the fiasco of Ralph Northam, Fairfax, and Herring, one of the best lines you gave me, and you, I don't even know if you remember this, but it was like the week after the whole thing blew up with Northam calling for him to resign and then Mark Herring, two-face, blackface, and the hypocrisy of that, and then Fairfax. And you were coming off the elevator, and I was leaving the General Assembly, and I said to you, Danica, what do you think of this mess with these three statewide elected officials? And you had the best line in the 2019 General Assembly. You looked at me and you said, Route 28, and you walked away. And I've said that on the radio multiple times. It's like this lady gets it, right? She's there to do her constituents the job. And she looked at me and she said, Route 28, and walked away. And I told a bunch of people that I thought that was the best line of the 2019 General Assembly. But how does your look, being there, Danica, and serving there now, this is your second year. Are there in your colleagues there? I mean, we get the Westboro thing and they don't like transgenders or gays or whatever they're doing. That's their business. But from your colleagues, has anybody put any pressure on you or made you feel uncomfortable within the General Assembly itself, within your colleagues?
So the overwhelming majority of my colleagues have, to my face, been respectful. And I've actually gotten some good friendships and good working professional relationships across the aisle right now, which has been really good. I mean, that's how I passed three bills, is, you know, by working with people from across, you know, district lines. And at one point, I even drove down to Virginia Beach to go and work on legislation with Delegate Mieres in his office, Delegate Davis in his office, and then even drove down to Suffolk after that to meet up with Delegate Brewer. I mean, like, I'm very, very willing to meet, you know, my Republican colleagues literally where they are so that we can, you know, work on legislation together. And that's been a very good thing for not just my, you know, record here, but, you know, just for the General Assembly. Like, you know, I've had things come up here and there where one member, and I never attack a colleague by name. It's just, it's not what I do. You know, I never attack a constituent. Don't attack my colleagues. But, you know, I did have, you know, one issue the second to last day of the 2018 session where a colleague asked me to come outside for a breath of fresh air. And then as soon as I stepped in outside, tried to save my soul and, you know, started telling me stuff where I just said, excuse me, what are you going to tell me that I haven't heard through 13 years of Catholic school? Baptized, confirmed over at All Saints Catholic Church in Manassas, whole nine yards. What are you going to actually tell me at this point that's different? And that person said, oh, I didn't know that. I was like, yeah, no kidding. But, you know, some of the things that you've said have been absolutely horrible. And the idea that you can tell me about my salvation when you haven't demonstrated that on your own really, really speaks poorly. And I was, it's one of those things where it's so wildly unprofessional to be going up to, you know, one of your LGBT, you know, colleagues and trying to convert them on the spot. That's not why your constituents sent you to Richmond. It's do your job. You know, it's just do constituent service, file your bills, work across party lines, and if you have questions with other people, then go ask them. If you have, you know, if you want to be friendly, that's fine. But when you're coming up like that, that's malicious intent. And whether, you know, it's being coaxed or anything else, that's not okay. And I want to make sure that, you know, we all maintain professional working relationships and that we have the decorum that the General Assembly deserves in the first place and that our constituents expect us to uphold when they send us to Richmond. Because keep in mind, it's not about us. It's about the 83,000 people each of us represent back home. Mm-hmm. It's not about R versus D. It's about Virginia. That's the bottom line.
Well, Danica, look, I'm sorry you had to go through that. And obviously in the situation that you're in, the courage that you had and you know, being the first transgender woman elected to the General Assembly, and, you know, you've got, I guess, some House of Delegates members in there that have very strong convictions and think they can change your situation. But, look, I mean, everybody's got to live their own life the way they want to within the legal bounds of the United States. You've certainly done that, and I just think that's a little out of line. And you're right. I mean, the delegates were sent there to represent their constituents, and they have to answer to them just like you have to answer to your constituents in November for District 13, and that they're going to decide whether to send you back or not. I want to get your opinion on something else that went unnoticed, and because I've got you on, and I know you're not going to vote for Trump in 2020 like I am, so we're not going to see eye to eye there. But I just want to point this out, okay?
Yes, sir.
Do you know that at the Conservative Political Action Conference, which I was at in the People's Republic of Maryland last week?
Right, and remember, we first met at CPAC when I was covering that for the hotline back in, I think, 2013 or 2012.
So, that's right, we did. You know. And I was right there on Radio Row, and that's how we met. That's why I wanted to get you on today and bring this up. But one of the things that the president mentioned in his speech that went unnoticed by a lot of people, but not by me, was his public support for the Trump administration's policy of decriminalizing homosexuality globally. And nobody really picked this up, but a handful of people. This is being led by Richard Grenell, who was the highest-ranking openly gay person in the Trump administration. Right now, he is the ambassador to the Republic of Germany right now. And that totally, in his two-hour speech, got swept to the side, except for a handful of people. So I'm going to give you an opportunity, even though you don't agree with him, you're not going to vote for him, an opportunity to commend the president on doing that.
What I would say is it should be obvious for any person who is in, you know, federal office that if you are trying to, you know, support a message of inclusion, if you're trying to, you know, make the world safer for your own constituents, that of course your LGBTQ constituents should be able to love who they want to love and how they want to love, you know, outside of, you know, the country. I mean, like, that's just basic. And at the same time, you know, I would be someone here who I don't like to wade into federal politics much. That's not what my constituents elected me to do. But when, you know, trans people in Prince William County are being told not to serve in the military, I have a huge problem with that. And so I would like to see that, you know, we deal with a lot of our domestic issues here in a much more inclusive way from the federal government. And yes, it is a good thing to tell people that, hey, you know, and it's a good thing for, you know, Richard Grenell to, you know, tell people, hey, you know, this is something that we should be doing, you know, this is something that we should be doing. And at the same time, I think that the record that, you know, I've unfortunately had to disagree a lot with, you know, domestically suggests that there's a lot of work to be done on LGBTQ equality here at home other than just rhetoric, because I am very, very upset regarding the military ban that I think is absolutely misguided in every way possible from advisors giving awful, awful advice.
Yeah, but he's taking that advice, Danica. Come on, that's not fair. He's taking that advice directly from generals in the field. And so, you know, your beef is with them.
And you other generals who completely disagree with
him. Yeah, well, I mean, but, you know, he's got a number of generals giving him that advice. And, you know, the Democrats are saying, hey, you should pay more attention to your generals, so you can't have it both ways. So we're not going to see eye to eye on that because I don't think that's a fair – I just don't think that's a fair – criticism of it. Obama didn't do it either. And so, but look, Trump, you cannot deny that President Trump has been a friend to the LGBT community since he's been there. And he's the first Republican ever as president, even a candidate, to take the gay rights issue off the table and back it. And so you have to give him that. And also our good friend, Richard Grenell. Danica,
But John, even on that, while I disagree with your assessment there, I do agree that you have been respectful, kind, professional every time. I think I've been on your show at least four times, I remember.
Yes.
And you've always been, you know, absolutely kind to me, and I genuinely, genuinely appreciate the fact that you've conducted yourself so respectfully and cordially and professionally, and I've really, really gotten, you know, enjoy getting to know you here.
Thank you for all you do. I gotta go. Joining us now is Dave Ray. Dave is the Director of Communications and Spokesman for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Dave, good to have you on, man.
Hey, John, how you doing, my friend? Good to be with you.
Good. You guys put a statement out. I just wanted to get into this a little bit. Yesterday, DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testified before a congressional committee declaring that illegal immigration is spiraling out of control. Can you share, Dave Ray, some of the numbers?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely correct. And, you know, just to give you a comparison, in 2014, the first quarter of 2014, when President Obama declared that there was a humanitarian crisis at the border, for example, we had about 165,000 illegal alien apprehensions for that quarter. For this first quarter, testified the secretary yesterday, those have exploded. We have nearly 272,000 apprehensions, and we are set for the first time in more than a decade to eclipse more than 1 million apprehensions at the southwest border this year. Those are the ones who we catch. For everyone who's not caught, they estimate that one comes in. But for anybody who denies that there's a humanitarian and public safety crisis at the border, they are absolutely playing ostrich. The secretary yesterday talked about the human carnage created by the smugglers who are enticing people to spend their life savings to try to come here to skirt our immigration laws. You know, 31% of women are being sexually molested on the way up, 17% of men. The secretary yesterday said they are now regularly administering rape kits to girls 10 years and over. So this is not the way to bring people to the United States. It's caused primarily by two things: the ease at which they can get into the country because the lack of a border wall in key areas and deterrent structures along other parts of the border, and then these loopholes in our asylum laws that are so easily exploited that virtually anyone with a child will not only be admitted into the United States and join a backlog of a million people waiting to have their cases heard, but they will be released into the interior, hence the word catch and release. So Congress's inaction has created a real crisis on the border. The Border Patrol can't manage this. They are being overwhelmed, and things are at a breaking point.
Dave, let me ask you this. You mentioned that there's a one-to-one relationship between those illegals that are apprehended at the border and those that are not. Is that do you have solid stats on that?
Well, it's a Border Patrol estimate. I mean, you know, no, of course nobody knows how many people aren't caught, but I've heard it as high as Border Patrol spokesmen have said it's been as high as two are, you know, get by for everyone that's caught. But I think a one-to-one ratio is fair. Let's be honest, you know, in places where we have a border wall, illegal alien apprehensions have become manageable. I mean, the San Diego sector, for example, used to just be an absolute flood of people. They now have 14 miles of border wall there, and that sector is largely under control. But we have reports, and this is from NPR, so it's no right-wing hack news outlet. NPR is reporting that buses from Guatemala are coming up full of people, stopping at the border and letting these folks off. And the second they step one foot in the United States, they say the words political asylum, and then their legal process starts. They, if you have a child with you, which is the key, then you can't be held by the United States for more than 20 days. They're released into the country. The vast majority of these folks will not qualify. They are not fleeing political oppression. They are not asylees. If they were fleeing political oppression in Guatemala, then it begs the question, why didn't you stay in Mexico then? Because the government of Guatemala certainly wasn't chasing you there. But, you know, they say 30% of these folks won't even bother to file their political asylum paperwork. Another 40% won't bother to show up for their hearing. When it's all said and done, these hundreds and thousands of people who are being admitted into the country under these false asylum claims, about 9% of them will actually be granted asylum. The rest will be in the country living illegally. And, you know, obviously we know very little about these folks, so we're not really quite sure who we've let in.
Total scam. And only 9% are actually authentic of these people claiming political asylum. Dave, I'm out of time. I want to thank Dave Ray for being with us at FAIR, the Federation of American Immigration Reform.
You're listening to The John Frederick Show, Common Sense for the Commonwealth, on great radio stations across Virginia and online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.